In the 4th century, the soldier and historian Ammianus Marcellinus ended his account of some fairly minor operations in Gaul by saying that, besides these battles, many others less worthy of mention were fought, which it would be superfluous to describe, both because their results led to nothing worthwhile, and because it is not fitting to spin out a history with insignificant details. Warfare is underreported in our sources for the army on the wall, but even so, we can confidently state that it was an occasional or rare experience for most Roman soldiers. Even during a major campaign, many troops spent far more time marching and waiting, or drilling and preparing, than they spent in combat. Some men would never meet the enemy in battle or skirmish in their entire 25 years in the army, whereas others, no doubt, had more than their fair share of fighting. The bulk of a man's military service was spent in the routines of peace, with conflict a more or less distant prospect. Yet, for all that, Hadrian's Wall and the communities around it existed because of the army, and the regulations and habits of the Roman army were at the heart of life there. In one sense, the army never slept, for sentries were always on duty at any time of day or night, but its day formally started around sunrise with trumpet calls to rouse the garrison, and then parades and a gathering of officers in the Principia. Among the Vindolanda tablets are many formulaic morning reports dating to the early years of the 2nd century. 15th of April. Report of Cohors 9, Batavorum. All who should be are at duty stations, as is the baggage. The Optiones and Curatores made the report. Arcutius, Optio of the century of Crescens, delivered it. The Optio was second in command to the centurion in charge of each century, and the curator fulfilled the same role for the decurion in charge of a turma of cavalrymen. It seems that one of them would act as spokesman for the day and deliver the report, which was based on a roll call taken of each subunit. Documents from other frontiers make it clear that a statement of overall numbers serving in the unit and their availability was given each morning and written down to be filed in the records. A new password for the day was issued, as well as other orders. A duty roster for a century from a legion stationed in Egypt records the fatigues assigned to its soldiers over a period of 10 days, including such things as gate guard, baths, escort to Centurion Serenus, street cleaning, and latrines. A soldier's entire career was tracked and recorded, starting with enlistment. Caius Longinus Priscus, aged 22, scar on left eyebrow. The final record was death or discharge. Released from service. Tryphon, son of Dionysius, suffering from cataract and impaired vision. The recording of animals acquired by the army was almost as full. Enter in the records according to regular procedure, a horse, 4 years old, reddish, masked, without brands, approved by me, assign it to Julius Bassus, trooper. Pay generated considerable documentation. Soldiers were supposed to be paid in 3 instalments each year, each of 100 silver denarii, or 400 of the smaller sesterii, for legionaries in Hadrian's day, although the rate received by auxiliaries is unclear. A pay receipt from Egypt gives a breakdown of the numerous deductions made from the money a soldier was supposed to receive. This dates to a time when legionaries received only 225 denarii a year. Auxiliary pay is unlikely to have been higher, and may have been lower. Also, in this case, the pay and accounting were done in the local drachma coin, which was roughly the equivalent of the sesterius. Other men show deductions made for lost or newly issued clothing and gear, but some of the charges, for instance for food, appear to be standard. Equally detailed accounts were kept for all the hundreds of men in every unit, giving some idea of the vast amount of documentation generated by the army and stored in the Principia of each fort. Apart from men and animals, equipment was also inspected, and a writing tablet from Carlisle, dating to a generation before Hadrian's Wall, deals with shortages in a cavalry ala, listing men turma by turma. Docilis to Augurinus, his perfect greetings. As you ordered, we have attached below all the names of lancers who are missing lances, either who did not have fighting lances, or who did not have the smaller subarmales, probably a type of jerkin worn with a cuirass, or who did not have regulation swords. Much documentation also followed the huge amounts of supplies required by the army. Another text from Carlyle lists the grain supplied to an ala of cavalry. In total, 669 bushels of barley and 2,267 bushels of wheat, broken down into the amount allocated to each of the 16 turmi in the unit. The number of soldiers actually present at a garrison varied considerably, and is rarely likely to have matched its theoretical size and organisation. A strength report of Gohor's One Tungrorum, stationed at Vindolanda in the late 1st century AD, states that it had 752 men, including 6 centurions on its books, a high proportion of its probable establishment of some 800 men. However, of these, only 296 and 1 centurion were at the fort, and 31 of these were unfit for duty. One centurion was in Londinium, 2 others off at other locations, each with a very small detachment of soldiers, while 45 men were on a long-term posting serving with the foot bodyguard of the provincial governor. The largest group of 337 men under 2 centurions was at Coria, almost certainly Corbridge, within a day's march, so relatively close. Flavius Ceralis, prefect of 9 Batavorum, referred to Vindolanda as his winter quarters, hiverna, using a term familiar from Caesar, and it is likely that many units spent the colder months at their bases, but were often serving elsewhere in spring and summer. The same pattern of dispersal is reflected in other strength returns from units in other provinces, with officers and men away from their parent cohort or ala, sometimes a long way away, even in different provinces, and for long periods of time. Wherever they were, the army's bureaucracy kept track of them. Mile castles and turrets needed manning by detachments, and even if the distances involved were short and the men were not too far away from the main garrison, they were still not available instantly. The legionary presence at Corbridge and Carlisle, and perhaps at times other bases, brought men for months and perhaps longer up from the fortresses at Caerleon, Chester and York. Detachments or vexillations from legions in other parts of the empire came to northern Britain at times, and elements of the army of Britannia, presumably including units stationed on the wall, were similarly posted away to other provinces as required. Life in the garrison continued, however many or few soldiers were actually present. Records needed to be kept up to date, not least those tracking pay and the issuing of equipment and rations, which in turn meant supervision of the granaries and stores. Most forts also had their workshops, fabrici, where weapons, armour, helmets, harnesses, horse fittings and saddles, tents, shield covers, and a host of other things were manufactured and repaired, and soldiers were required to work in these and to run them. Horses could not spend all their time in their boxes, and needed to be exercised and cared for, as did the mules, ponies, and oxen used as pack and draft animals. Some of these tasks were performed by the army slaves, or personal slaves owned by some soldiers, especially cavalrymen, but much was done by the legionaries and auxiliaries themselves. Maintenance of the fort's buildings and the wall and its other installations was a common task, with periodic new constructions or wholesale rebuilding creating bigger projects. Each task was underpinned by such things as tile-making, quarrying and shaping stone, felling trees and working timber, as well as moving men and materials to where they were needed, so that behind the matter-of-fact inscriptions recording the erection or repair of a building lay a hive of activity. Hadrian was an advocate of rigorous military training, as were all good emperors, and a series of inscriptions from North Africa records the speeches he gave to several army units after watching them at manoeuvres. One cavalry ala, "Filled the training ground with your wheelings. You threw spears not ungracefully, though with short and stiff shafts. Several of you hurled lankier spears with skill. Your jumping onto horses was lively, and yesterday swift. Had anything been lacking, I would note it. You pleased equally throughout the whole manoeuvre." Afterwards, he watched the horsemen from a cohors equitata, who were paid less and were less well mounted than the prestigious cavalry in the Ali. Hadrian began by telling them that "it is hard for the horsemen of a cohort to please, even as they are, and harder still not to displease after a show by the horsemen of an ala. The training field differs in size, spear throwers are fewer, the build of horses and the shine of weapons in keeping with the pay level. But you have banished weariness by your eagerness, by doing briskly what had to be done. Moreover, you both shot stones from slings and fought with javelins. Everywhere you jumped nimbly onto your horses. Praise was occasionally leavened with constructive criticism, for instance, when some archers formed into ranks too slowly, and some cavalry pursued too fast during a mock battle, so that they fell into disorder. No doubt, long preparation underlay the good performance of the army in Africa, as it was likely to have had plenty of warning of an imperial visit, and would have done its best to impress him. Provincial legates were expected to inspect the troops under their command and report on their condition, but the opportunity for all types of training had to compete with many other demands on soldiers' time, and there was the tendency for units to be heavily under strength and dispersed over a wide area. In ideal conditions, there was an emphasis on physical fitness and individual weapon skills, fencing at a post and sparring with an opponent, throwing javelins, shooting at targets for archers, while cavalry practiced vaulting in and out of the saddle, something especially important before the invention of the stirrup, horsemanship, and throwing javelins on the move. A cow skull from Vindolanda was put on a post and used as a target by soldiers practicing with a scorpio, or small, bolt-shooting ballista. However, in general, it is hard to identify the army's parade grounds and training areas archaeologically, so we do not know much about where such things took place. Literary sources also speak of group training, including route marches, formation drill, building temporary camps, and mock battles. Josephus, who was one of the leaders of the Jewish revolt against the Romans, and thus had actually fought against the Roman army in the 1st century AD, spoke of an army always preparing for war, and claimed that its drills were bloodless battles, and their battles bloody drills. One of the provincial governor's duties was to inspect the units under his command and report on their condition, ordering any problems to be rectified. The ideal state of readiness was seldom achieved, for it was a question of balancing all the tasks given to the army with keeping it ready for its military role. More than once, the Romans were caught unprepared when a major war developed unexpectedly. If they had advance warning, then there was time for intensive training to bring units to a much higher state of readiness. Whether training, writing and filing documents, building a road, repairing a spearhead, or cleaning out the latrines, soldiers needed to eat and rest. The army issued a daily ration of grain, usually wheat, often supplemented by meat, such as beef, mutton, or bacon. Legionaries seem to have received more pork than auxiliaries, reflecting traditional Italian tastes, even though by Hadrian's reign very few soldiers were recruited into the legions from Italy. Bone finds from auxiliary forts, including those on the wall, show auxiliaries eating substantial amounts of beef, but even more mutton and lamb, much of this probably sourced locally. Most troops had a mixed diet of meat and vegetables, especially lentils, although analysis of the drain from a latrine at the fort at Beersden on the Antonine Wall suggested that its garrison was almost wholly vegetarian. Food was issued raw or unprepared. With wheat, for instance, it was up to the soldiers to grind the grain to flour and cook it. Often this was done as a group by the men who shared a pair of barrack rooms, perhaps assisted by slaves if they owned them, or their wives if they had them. There was no equivalent to the canteen or mess hall, and men ate in and around the barracks. The army had two basic meals in the day, breakfast, prandium, in the morning, and dinner, classicum, at the end of the day. Wine was issued, usually the sour, vinegar-like acetum, or the cheap posca, although beer, cerveza, appears to have been more popular, especially with troops recruited from northern Europe. One of the Vindolanda tablets consists of a letter written by a decurion to his prefect, asking for orders, but at the end adding, "My fellow soldiers have no beer. Please order some to be sent." On campaign, hardtack biscuit, bucellatum, and salted bacon were common. Diet was supplemented by hunting and fishing, where this was possible, and by the purchase of extras, including better wine, fruit, eggs, meat of various sorts, fish, and oysters. A great variety of products was available to be bought in the forts and Wiki, and in towns like Corbridge and Carlisle. Requests for leave are common in the Vindolanda tablets, and it is unclear whether these were for long periods and meant to allow an auxiliary to return to his homeland in the Netherlands, or for short passes to visit a much closer town and enjoy its pleasures. After the wall had been built, the population of the whole area grew considerably, making even more goods and services available to soldiers who were careful to save their pay. Officers and their households inevitably ate better and more exotic food than the ordinary soldiers. One of the Vindolanda tablets was written by the slave Severus to another slave, Candidus, owned by the prefect Genialis, arranging for him to purchase goods that included radishes. Another letter, again probably from slave to slave, gave instructions for the purchase of a range of goods needed by a large household, including bruised beans, 2 modii, chickens, 20, 100 apples, if you can find nice ones, 100 or 200 eggs, if they are for sale at a fair price, 8 sextarii of fish sauce, a modius of olives. Although less able than officers to afford many luxuries, it is striking just how many types of food, drink, and other goods were widely available to ordinary soldiers on Hadrian's Wall and at other outposts of the empire. Soldiers generally owned more than one pair of shoes, with boots for their uniform, lighter shoes for indoors, and wooden sandals for going to the bathhouse with its heated floors. This is in contrast to most people in the Middle Ages who owned just a single pair of shoes, only replacing them when they were worn out. Even in the late 1st and early 2nd century, the Vindolanda tablets show an army base fully connected to the long-distance trade that flourished under the empire. The Wiki outside forts offered inns where men could eat and drink, play board or dice games and gamble, and no doubt engage the services of prostitutes. In the civilian community around housesteads, excavation has revealed loaded dice, traces of the forging of coins, and evidence of murder, all within yards of the rampart of the fort. The murder victims were an aging couple buried beneath the floor of one of the houses. Presumably, at the time, they simply vanished, as their remains were only uncovered by archaeologists, and the same is true of the boy whose skeleton was discovered under the floor of a barrack block at Vindolanda. No doubt, life on Hadrian's Wall could be brutal and was often bawdy and rough, but we should not push this image too far, for this was a zone regulated by the army. A merchant who had been beaten by soldiers felt able to complain to a senior officer at Vindolanda, most likely the prefect, and clearly believed that this was worthwhile and might bring some form of recompense. Plenty of civilians were drawn to the area and made prosperous lives for themselves, and some discharged soldiers chose to stay close to where they had served. A man named Barates came from Palmyra in modern Syria, an oasis city on the Silk Road, and was either a serving or former soldier, or perhaps a merchant supplying standards to the army. At some point he bought a slave woman named Regina, Queen or Queenie, a Briton from the Catavellauni who lived north of the Thames. He freed her and married her, and when she died he set up an expensive monument depicting her sitting in a wicker chair and dressed as a proper Roman matron. The text is mainly in Latin, but at the bottom he had added in the curving script of his own Semitic dialect, Regina, the freedwoman of Barates, alas. Tombstones testify to an ethnically diverse community, but also to familiar and natural human emotions, as people commemorated friends, husbands, wives, lovers, or comrades. Monuments to children are among the most poignant, such as those to a 5-year-old girl with the somewhat Germanic name Artela, the 6-year-old, very dear daughter, Julia Materna, or Ertula, properly called Welibia, who lived most happily 4 years and 60 days, whose tombstone bears a childlike picture of her holding a ball. At South Shields, a father inscribed this memorial to his son, "Sacred to the spirits of the departed," or Deus, lived 9 years, 9 months. Lucius Aruntius Salvianus erected this tombstone, to his deserving and most devoted son. The same site produced another monument to Victor, a Moorish tribesman, aged 20, freedman of Numerianus, cavalryman in Ala I Asturum, who most devotedly conducted him to his tomb. The dead young man is depicted reclining at a feast, and it is impossible to know whether he was a fondly regarded servant or a lover. Religion and ritual were everywhere in the ancient world, and many inscriptions are religious in nature, with altars dedicated to gods and goddesses from all over the empire. Especially common are the guardian deities of Rome itself, revered as part of the official annual rituals of the army and state. Substantial, well-carved altars dedicated to Jupiter Optimus Maximus, best and greatest, often bear the names of a senior officer and his unit, and may well have been dedicated at a formal parade. For instance, to Jupiter, best and greatest, Lucius Camius Maximus, prefect of cohorts 1 Hispanorum Equitata, willingly and deservedly fulfilled his vow. Others are far more personal, although no less expensive. The Mithraeum, or Temple to Mithras, at Carolburg, gives an idea of the dark, cavern-like shrines where this eastern god was worshipped. Mithraism was a mystery religion, its devotees sworn to secrecy about its rites, and initiated to ever more senior levels in a cult that stressed manly virtues. It appears to have had particular appeal to equestrian officers, and perhaps was a useful way to make connections with other men of a similar rank, as well as an emotionally satisfying experience. The inscriptions on the main altars from this temple have a formal tone similar to other dedications by equestrian commanders of auxiliary units. For instance, to the invincible god Mithras Lucius Antonius Proculus, prefect of cohorts 1 Batavorum Antoniniani, willingly and deservedly fulfilled his vow. Nearby is the shrine to the goddess Coventina and the nymphs, a temple built around a natural spring. It has yielded a good number of inscriptions, but the cult remains hard to pin down, and opinion is divided over whether Coventina was already a local deity when the Romans arrived, or was imported from one of the Celtic parts of the empire. Combining local gods and goddesses with Greco-Roman equivalents was fairly common, so that we have Vinotonus, the god of the hunt, renamed as Silvanus, and the related Cocidius, who was equated with Mars. The outpost fort at Bewcastle was called Farnum Cocidii, and appears to have enclosed an existing place of worship for the local population, probably to allow the Romans to regulate tribal gatherings. In spite of the suppression of the Druidic cult by the Romans in the 1st century AD, there is little sign of a direct clash between belief systems in northern Britain. In most cases, local religions were not seen as incompatible with the culture and religion of the empire, because for polytheists, the addition of new gods and goddesses presented few problems. The Druids were a rare exception to this, partly because the Romans were disgusted by their practice of human sacrifice, and also because, as a priesthood with authority beyond that of tribes and local leaders, they had the potential to unite Britons in opposition to Rome. As a consequence, the religion was outlawed, and its most sacred shrines destroyed when the Roman army raided the Isle of Mona, modern Anglesey, in AD 60. Such direct conflict with a religious group was rare, but that is not to say that Roman appropriation of native cults and shrines represented a mutual and willing coming together of cultures. The locals may well have ignored many of the Roman versions of their cults and may have been permitted to continue their traditional practices. There is little direct evidence for Christianity on Hadrian's Wall until well into the 4th century AD, but this is generally true of Roman Britain and thus unsurprising. The early Christian church is hard to detect archaeologically, for it set up very few inscriptions, and it was not until much later that buildings recognizable as churches began to be built. It seems reasonable to assume that there were Christians as individuals and organized churches on the wall as there were in most of the empire, at first on a small scale, but gradually becoming more common. Once the Emperor Constantine adopted the new religion, 306 to 337, Christians became considerably more visible as part of the wider community. There is evidence for a very large building that was quite probably a church outside the fort at Maryport on the Cumbrian coast in the later 4th century, and there may have been smaller churches at Vindolanda, Housesteads, and South Shields. Altars and temples can survive as tangible traces of beliefs and rituals, but many other aspects of daily life leave little or no archaeological trace. One of the most striking features of the Vindolanda tablets is the normality of garrison life and trade on Britain's northern frontier, and especially the social life of unit commanders and their families. Claudia Sewera to her Lepidina, greetings. On the 11th of September, sister, for the day of the celebration of my birthday, I give you a warm invitation to make sure that you come to us, to make the day more enjoyable for me by your arrival, if you are present. Give my greetings to your Kerialis. My Elias and my little son send him their greetings. I shall expect you, sister. Farewell, sister, my dearest soul, as I hope to prosper and hail. If life was settled enough for such pleasantries a generation before Hadrian's Wall, then it was surely at least as secure for much of the time after its construction, when far more troops were concentrated in the area. Equestrian officers and their wives were the most senior people living for years on end in the forts on the wall or the outposts beyond it. The wife of one prefect at High Rochester, north of the wall, was a senator's daughter. She would have run their extensive household just as she would have done at home, managing slaves and freedmen, as well as overseeing the education and care of her own children. If comforts were a little less than in settled provinces, and certainly great public entertainments and festivals were rare events and smaller in scale, these women, like their husbands, were still living a generally familiar version of the lifestyle of their class. The same was true of the junior officers and their families, and of the soldiers and civilians in and around the forts. Life on Hadrian's Wall was, in most respects, much like life in the rest of the Roman Empire. People wore similar clothes, adopted the same fashions, and no doubt told the same stories and sang the same songs as people elsewhere. 8. How Hadrian's Wall Worked. Understanding the Evidence. Hadrian's Wall forced peaceful travellers to cross at either a mile castle in the initial design, or later at a fort or one of the small number of other gates. This permitted the Roman authorities to monitor everyone who came through the military zone, allowing them to refuse passage if they chose, and to levy a toll on those who did cross if this was felt appropriate. All of this mirrors the army's supervision of movement in other frontier regions or sensitive areas, such as the routes to and from the ports on Egypt's Red Sea coast. In the case of northern Britain, we cannot say how many civilians routinely crossed the wall, who they were or what business they had. When the wall was abandoned and the Antonine Wall established instead, it is striking how much effort went into slighting the Walum and making crossing places over it, and also into removing gates at mile castles. This does suggest that there was enough traffic through the line of the wall to make this all worthwhile, but it does not tell any more about who these travellers were or why they wanted to cross. Nevertheless, it is hard to imagine that the Romans would have gone to such lengths to build the wall and to maintain and man it for the best part of 300 years, if its sole purpose was as a grand customs barrier. The presence of so many soldiers, perhaps 10,000 to 15,000 in the early 3rd century, and possibly half that number or even less by the early 4th century, makes it clear that there was a perceived and serious military threat, which meant that Hadrian's Wall was recommissioned after the decision to abandon the Antonine Wall. There would have been no need to do this had the wall been simply the vanity project or grand architectural statement of Hadrian. Yet the Roman army was designed for mobile warfare and not static defence. Its doctrine was aggressive, both at the strategic and tactical levels, relying on its superior command and control, discipline, training, and equipment to give it an advantage over all opponents, and especially a tribal army consisting of a small number of semi-professional warriors backed by a mass of enthusiastic but untrained and undisciplined tribesmen. The larger a tribal army became, the harder it was for its leaders to control and maneuver it, magnifying all of the Romans' advantages, so that often small Roman columns were able to defeat numerically far larger enemy armies. In all its phases, Hadrian's Wall was designed to allow the Roman army ready access across its line. By the 3rd century, more than one-fourth of the soldiers stationed in or near the wall were cavalrymen, with 3 ordinary ali and a larger elite miliary ala, the ala Petriana at Stanwix, as well as the horsemen in the mixed cohorts and some irregulars. Such a strong force of good-quality cavalrymen allowed the army to patrol far in advance of the wall, and even well beyond its outpost forts. They acted as a reminder of Roman strength and of the army's long reach, while providing intelligence of the mood of the local tribes and leaders. More information came from allies, spies, and informers. Diplomatic activity was equally vital, whether to ensure goodwill through payment of subsidies to native leaders, or in meetings that allowed Roman representatives to gauge chieftains' moods and ask about their neighbours. On other frontiers, we hear of centurions sitting in at tribal councils, and the Vindolanda tablets mention men with the title of Centurio Regionarius, who probably were responsible for dealings with the locals in a set area. Major wars were rare, and through all these sources of information, the army hoped to have plenty of warning when they were brewing. If more urgent diplomacy, threats, and bribes then failed to deal with the situation, the army mustered one or more columns from the troops available and marched out to confront and defeat any enemies in the open. Far more often than not, this was successful. Problems arose only if the enemy proved stronger and more skillful than expected, or, and this was a bigger risk, the garrisons of the wall zone were depleted, overstretched, undertrained, or badly led. Then there was a risk of defeat and ignominious retreat. Hadrian's Wall was not designed to withstand attack by a large and determined hostile army, for it was too long for the defenders to be strong at every point. Given that it was most likely to be attacked when its garrisons were weaker than usual and incapable of defeating the enemy well in advance of the wall, this problem of a defending force stretched out too thinly to defend such an extensive position only became worse. A strong attacking force would be able to overwhelm the defences at a given point and seize one of the gateways. The blocking up of many Mile Castle gateways forced attackers towards the forts or major crossings, which were better protected, but since any trouble was likely to occur at a time of weakness, this was not in itself always enough to prevent their capture. Hadrian's Wall would not stop a strong enemy force, but it would slow it down. It took time and perhaps casualties to seize a crossing, and then more time to pass through gateways and cross the Walum. These delays provided the Romans with more time to recover and to bring troops from elsewhere in the province, or from the rest of the empire, so that eventually they had a strong enough force to defeat the enemy in open battle. How long this took depended on the wider situation, and at times of military crisis on other frontiers, and even more during the frequent civil wars of the 3rd and 4th centuries, it might be many months or years before an effective military response was possible. Most of the time, the Romans were sufficiently strong that the wall and its garrison, combined with an active diplomatic presence farther north, either deterred major attacks or dealt with them effectively in the field. Smaller-scale aggression was a different matter, and when we consider this, the design of the wall makes a good deal more sense. Raiding was common in most Iron Age societies and was the most frequent type of warfare. The communities north of Hadrian's Wall were loosely organized, and a treaty with a tribe did not automatically bind all chieftains or individuals within the group to keep the peace. A successful raid brought profit from plunder, whether goods, livestock, or captives as slaves, as well as glory, demonstrating the might of a leader and his followers. Hadrian's Wall was a barrier to unauthorized crossing, while its garrison provided substantial numbers of soldiers, many of them mounted, to hunt down and engage any raiding band. In normal circumstances, it would be just a matter of time before attackers were intercepted. The wall helped to give the Romans the time to respond. Even before an attack, it made it much harder for spies to cross and find suitable targets for the raid. On other frontiers, many tribes were only allowed to attend a few markets held on or near the frontiers, and it was a privilege and mark of trust to be permitted to travel more widely within the empire. Without prior information on where to find farms, villas, temples, or other sources of spoils, raiders had to spend time during the attack finding what they wanted. Getting across Hadrian's Wall was not easy, as the ditch, obstacles, and the lay of the land slowed down attackers. The wall itself might be climbed by men, but it blocked the path for horses, restricting mobility on the other side. From the start, there was the risk of being spotted by patrols north of the wall, and even more while trying to get across it. Large bands were inevitably more visible. A handful of men might sneak across, but if they were seen, even the small detachment at a turret, or a few men patrolling the wall itself, assuming there was indeed a walkway, could delay and inflict casualties on them. After the wall, there was the Walum to cross, bringing more delay and even greater chance of being observed. Bigger bands might fight their way across, overwhelming the men at a mile castle and crossing there, but this was hard to do without raising the alarm. The wall could be crossed in secret, especially under cover of darkness, or in low visibility during fog, heavy rain, or snow, although even in these circumstances there was a risk of being seen. A simple alert, whether from a beacon, flag signal, or dispatch rider, warned the nearest garrisons of danger, allowing them to prepare a response and to start sending out scouts to gather more information. A plundering raid left a trail of attacked settlements, ambushed travellers, and stolen flocks or herds in its wake. The more destructive a raid was, the more visible it became. Smoke from a burning farm was as good as a beacon for raising the alarm. For the raiders, each success brought its own problems. Plunder had to be transported, slowing the raiders down to the pace of burdened men if they carried what they had taken, or to the speed of pack or draft animals if they loaded it onto these. Stolen animals had to be herded, human captives watched to prevent escape, and valuable prisoners, such as women and children, might not be able to move at the fast pace set by warriors. Booty of all kinds was of value only if it could be carried home to safety, but successful raiders inevitably moved more slowly on the way back than on the way in. If they had acquired pack animals or carts, then these were harder to get across rivers in the path, not to mention the Walum and the wall itself. All the while, the Romans were hunting them. Time and again, on all frontiers, the Roman army was unable to prevent all raiders from getting into the provinces, but it often caught them and destroyed them as they turned for home. An altar, probably from Corbridge, recorded just such an interception. Quintus Calpurnius Concessinius, prefect of cavalry, after slaughtering a band of Corionototi, fulfilled his vow to the god of most efficacious power. This is the only mention of the Corionototi, so we do not know where they came from or how numerous and aggressive a people they were, assuming that the prefect had identified them correctly. As long as Hadrian's Wall was reasonably well garrisoned, it made successful raids across it very difficult. Some attackers may have circumvented the wall and come by sea, hence the installations along the Cumbrian coast designed in similar manner to spot any bands and allow them to be caught. Every raid intercepted and either captured or destroyed helped to frighten other potential attackers, just as every band that escaped with plunder encouraged others to try their luck. Another deterrent was the threat of Roman reprisals, effectively raids of their own, reaching north from the military zone and striking with dreadful force against the communities held responsible for attacks. The closest settlements were especially vulnerable, but the Romans were fully capable of assembling a large column and marching far to the north, even beyond the Fourth Clyde line. Raiding was a problem encountered by the Romans on many frontiers. Hadrian's Wall took advantage of the comparatively narrow neck of land between the Tyne and Solway to make entering and leaving the settled part of the province very hard. But in other respects, its approach was conventional. Ultimately, its success rested less on the fortifications and barriers than on the soldiers who manned them. Everything, from spotting raids to repelling them, to sending punitive expeditions north as a reprisal, and the ability to confront and defeat any large tribal army, relied on a numerous, well-trained and prepared military presence. At times this was lacking, which led to disasters. For instance, in 367, when some of the scouts and spies employed by the army were found to be in league with raiders. But for the greater part of three centuries, this military dominance was maintained in northern Britain by the Roman Empire. 9. Changing times and the end of empire. In addition to the cohorts and ali, irregular units appeared on Hadrian's Wall during the course of the 3rd century AD, such as the band, or numerus, of Naudifridius at Haustedts, or the German citizens of Twente serving in the column, or cuneus, of Frisians at the same fort. Pottery shows extensive presence of Germanic tribesmen and their families cooking in traditional ways at Haustedts, with some hint that they may have lived in a distinct part of the vicus rather than inside the fort. The Romans had a long tradition of recruiting warriors from recent enemies and posting them to a distant frontier, thus removing a potential source of trouble. Irregular units like these appear to have been commanded by their own leaders, such as Naudifridius, rather than by equestrian officers, and were most likely cheaper to raise. It is hard to say how much training their soldiers received, and whether they looked and fought more like warriors than soldiers. Such units may have helped boost troop numbers on the wall after the reduction in the size of cohorts and ali in the 230s, but by their nature they were less permanent. Similar allied and irregular units became more common throughout the empire around the same time. This was only one of the wider changes that altered the nature of the army on the wall. In 212, Caracalla extended Roman citizenship to the overwhelming majority of free inhabitants of the empire, which meant that many auxiliaries were now citizens. This status was less of an advantage than it had been in the past, as the law increasingly distinguished between citizens who were honestiores, or the more honest or honourable men, who were generally the rich and received far more lenient treatment, and the majority of humiliores, or more humble men, who were subject to harsher punishment for the same offences and had fewer rights. At times, soldiers were pampered by emperors eager to buy and keep their loyalty, and given donatives or special payments to celebrate accessions and imperial successes or landmarks. This did not prevent many from defecting to support popular or more generous commanders in the long cycle of civil war and usurpation. Decades of inflation reduced the value of regular military pay, so it is a mistake to see all soldiers as privileged members of society. By the late 3rd century, more and more soldiers were conscripts rather than volunteers. Later, military service was made compulsory for the sons of soldiers, and the punishments for draft dodgers became ever more severe. When some resorted to cutting off a thumb so that they could not hold a sword or shield, it was decreed that the state would accept 2 thumbless men in place of 1 with intact hands. As the 3rd century progressed, the remaining distinctions between legionaries and auxiliaries, as well as the differences in equipment, gradually faded. Over the course of the 3rd century, the distinctive banded armour, known to scholars as lorica segmentata, worn by many legionaries, fell into disuse, as did the equally distinctive heavy javelin or pilum. By the later 3rd century, legionaries and auxiliaries alike wore mail or scale armour, carried oval shields, and fought with a range of spears and javelins. Around the same time, the long Sparta sword, in the past used by the cavalry, was adopted by infantry as well, replacing the famous gladius short sword. Some troops also employed lead-weighted darts, or plumbati, several of which were sometimes carried clipped onto the back of the shield. By the 4th century, legions were much smaller units than in the past, probably numbering little more than 1,000 to 1,200 men, making them slightly bigger than the miliary cohorts of the auxilia. A lot of military equipment was now produced by state-owned factories rather than at army bases themselves, and it assumed a simpler, mass-produced and more uniform appearance. Clothing styles changed as well, with long-sleeved tunics and long trousers becoming universal, so that even emperors dressed in this way on campaign. As the army and empire changed, other developments took place at the local level, and the wall changed. Around the beginning of the 4th century, the outpost forts were abandoned, and there were major changes in the nature of the forts on Hadrian's Wall itself. The vici had flourished for some time, only to shrink and then vanish almost completely, perhaps as early as approximately 280, and certainly by the start of the 4th century. At Vindolanda, a temple to Jupiter Dolichenus was built inside the fort in the 3rd century, something that would have been unimaginable in earlier periods. There is also clear evidence for civilian presence inside the fort during the 4th century, including an area apparently used as a market, something that appears to be mirrored at other sites. It looks very much as if garrisons had become smaller. This in itself is likely over time to have reduced the numbers of people living in the Wiki, contributing to the disappearance of these settlements, as the civilians who continued to form part of the military community moved inside the fort. During this period, there is a substantial drop on the number of goods in the forts, suggesting the decline and eventual cessation of much long-distance trade. Coins are common, but were by this time usually of low value, and the impression is of smaller numbers of soldiers who were less able to afford luxuries. There is no more new Samian pottery or amphorae containing olive oil, products that were common in the past, even though they had been brought from outside the province. In contrast, towns such as Corbridge and Carlisle continue to thrive, so some merchants may well have moved to these larger communities. The fort at South Shields, at the mouth of the Tyne, was rebuilt early in the 4th century, with its buildings situated around a central crossroad. In this sense, it was a break from the traditional fort layout, but the 10 barracks were very similar to their small 3rd century predecessors, as was the Principia, or headquarters. The Praetorium, the commander's house, was in the southeast quarter of the fort, but its design was that of the familiar Mediterranean-style courtyard house, and was occupied until approximately 370 or 380. Wherever the men who commanded the fort came from, they clearly expected to live in the style of an Italian gentleman, just as their predecessors had done. Yet elsewhere there are signs that the army lacked some of the skill and resources of earlier periods. When the north wall of the fort at Housesteads became unsound, it was repaired by piling an earth bank against it and over it. Similar earth and timber repairs were done at Vindolanda and Bedoswald. In the last few decades of the 4th century, the arrangement of barracks in several forts became less ordered, with living accommodation taking the form of small structures no longer so neatly arranged in rows, and instead haphazardly laid out. When the courtyard Praetorium at South Shields fell out of use, it was not replaced by a similarly grand structure. At Bedoswald, one granary collapsed and was not rebuilt, but its companion was modified, the raised floor being taken up and the ground beneath filled before a new floor was laid, presumably because it was no longer used to store grain in a controlled temperature. Other sites also show the abandonment or conversion of granaries for other purposes, and where new granaries were built, they tended to be smaller. This suggests that it was no longer normal to store such large quantities of food in a fort, which likely reflects smaller garrisons, even when civilians are included, and a reliance on local supply. Some of the changes visible on Hadrian's Wall echo wider developments in the Roman Empire. At the start of the 3rd century, Septimius Severus had divided Britain into two provinces, most likely through fear that an ambitious governor might copy his example and fight his way to power in Rome. From then on, no province contained more than two legions. This desire to prevent any one official from holding too much authority was taken much further in the later 3rd and 4th centuries. Septimius Severus treated senators with great suspicion and gave a number of senior posts to equestrians instead. This trend increased during the 3rd century, until eventually senators ceased to hold military posts at all. Equestrians commanded legions and provinces, and in time most emperors were former equestrian officers. By the 4th century, Britain had become 4, and perhaps later 5, provinces, and in each one military command was separated from civilian administration. In addition, the army was divided into two, the comitatenses, or mobile field units, and the limitane, or frontier garrisons, which included the men on Hadrian's Wall. Each of these had wholly separate command structures. The result was to make it difficult for anyone to marshal the resources of a province to deal with any major military problem. Only when an emperor took an interest was anything likely to be done. Rarely was this the case, for Roman rivals always took priority over the security of the empire. More than once in the 3rd century, Britain split away under the rule of emperors whose power did not encompass the entire empire. Carausius was one of the most successful of these rulers, but, like so many emperors in this period, he was eventually murdered and replaced by one of his own officers, a man named Alectus. In 296, Constantius I invaded Britain, killing Alectus, and making a triumphal entry into London. Constantius was Caesar in the western provinces and one of the Tetrarchs, a group of four men sharing imperial rule. From that time on, it was usual for there to be more than one emperor at a time, even on those rare occasions when there was no challenger claiming power somewhere in the empire. Constantius stayed in Britain for a while, and he may have gone to the north. He returned to the island at least once in the decade to come, and there is evidence of rebuilding and repair work at forts on the wall under his command. He died in York in 306, and the army proclaimed his son Constantine as emperor, prompting a new civil war. It is probable that Constantine campaigned in the north early in his reign, for he took the name Britannicus Maximus, but later much of his reign was spent preparing for and fighting civil wars, as he steadily brought the entire empire under his sole control. One of his sons came to Britain in winter 342-343, and it is likely there was more fighting. The historian and former army officer Ammianus Marcellinus tells us that in 360, Picts and Scots, the latter a group that appears to have come to Scotland from Ireland, broke the peace that had been agreed upon, laying waste the regions near the frontier so that fear seized the provincials. Four units of comitatenses, at most a few thousand men, and an experienced commander were sent to deal with the problem. In 367-368, the same two groups, joined by the previously unknown Atacotti in a so-called conspiracy of barbarians, again raided the province, ranging far to the south, killing one Roman commander and capturing another. They were aided by information supplied by the army's own scouts, who were subsequently disbanded, but once again a proven officer, in this case the father of the future emperor Theodosius, was sent with four units to restore the situation. Both campaigns suggest weak frontier defences, allowing a rapid increase in the scale and frequency of raiding, until fairly modest reinforcement drove the attackers out of the province. In 382, Magnus Maximus, originally from Spain and now the Dux, a late Roman military rank, commanding the troops in Britain, fought a campaign against the Picts and Scots who had attacked the province. Encouraged by this victory, in the next year he declared himself emperor in direct challenge to Gratian, the emperor in the western provinces. Maximus invaded Gaul, but it is clear that he had already secured the support of many of Gratian's senior officers. When the armies met near Lutetia, modern Paris, there were a few minor skirmishes before Gratian's army defected en masse. The defeated emperor Gratian fled, but was caught and executed, leaving Maximus in charge of all provinces north of the Alps. Maximus, hoping to be recognized by Theodosius, emperor in the eastern provinces, allowed a lull of several years while the two sides negotiated. In 387, Maximus once again resorted to force and overran Italy. Theodosius responded the next year, launching a rapid offensive. Maximus was defeated, taken captive, and beheaded. There was some more fighting before his supporters were suppressed, and the western provinces once again secured by Theodosius and his two young co-rulers. This episode forms the background for Kipling's story of the centurion Parnesius, who is tasked with holding the wall even though the bulk of the army in Britain has been led away to fight in the civil war. In fact, we do not know what happened in the north during Maximus's bid for power, although it is clear that he must have drawn away many soldiers from the provincial garrison. Some inevitably died in battle or from disease in the civil war, while others may never have been sent back to their bases in Britain. Any civil war weakened the defences of all the empire's frontiers, and the consequences were inevitably worse for provinces directly involved in the fighting. Britain had a strong garrison for its size, so the men who controlled it were often confident enough to make a bid for imperial power. As an island, it also offered a fairly secure base and made it difficult for emperors based on the continent to launch a quick counter-attack in the early days when a new regime was especially vulnerable. Even so, it was not always easy for an aspiring emperor to control all of the troops stationed there, Between 406 and 407, no fewer than 3 usurpers to the imperial throne were proclaimed in Britain, the first 2 swiftly perishing at the hands of their own officers. The third, Constantius III, gathered enough soldiers to invade Gaul and, for a short while, held sway over a sizable part of the Western Empire. Influential men left behind in Britain clearly felt neglected, for they rebelled and rejected his rule. A late and not always very reliable source claims that in 410 a delegation from Britain went to the Emperor Honorius in Italy. They asked for help against barbarian attacks, only to be told to fend for themselves, according to the Byzantine writer Zosimus. By this time it is clear that the Roman state had ceased to function in Britain, so that effectively it had ceased to be part of the empire. Several years before this, newly minted currency had stopped reaching the island in any significant quantities, which is a clear sign of the end of military and civilian administration. Whatever the precise details of the process, formal rule of Britain by the Western Roman Empire ceased early in the 5th century. Over time, the Roman Empire's capacity to fight fires on several frontiers simultaneously had declined, rotting away over generations of internal power struggles and civil wars. Provinces were lost and not recovered, with no single event triggering the decline or marking the point of no return. The impression from the archaeological record is of units on Hadrian's Wall continuing to do their job throughout the 4th and into the early years of the 5th century. Occasionally new units arrived to reinforce the troops stationed there, but there were also periods of weakness, and these may well have been more common than in the past. Even so, there was no permanent collapse, and the wall was maintained under Roman control until the very end of the province. As the empire declined, so did its capacity to maintain the army and garrison distant provinces. Civil wars again and again took soldiers away from Britain and disrupted its administration. By the 4th century, the culture of senior army officers and senior civil servants was one of suspicion and fear, as they knew that accusations of disloyalty to the emperor would most likely be met by torture and death for themselves and their families. On more than one occasion, loyal and capable commanders felt that they had no option but to rebel, because their very success had made the emperor consider them as a threat. It was not a climate encouraging talent or initiative, and the permanent insecurity and suspicion of officers and officials at all levels contributed to an inertia at the heart of the government that made it hard for the empire to marshal and direct its still substantial resources to deal with problems on the frontiers. It is difficult to say whether or not the threats from outside the empire had grown greater, but the ability to cope with them had certainly declined. Every successful raid encouraged more attacks, a snowball effect that rapidly magnified the problems faced by the imperial authorities. Given the chance, Roman armies were still very efficient, better equipped, disciplined and trained than their opponents, and usually able to defeat them in battle. Yet the long decay of the administrative, financial and logistical structures of the army and the state underpinning this effectiveness made it rarer and rarer for provincial armies to reach such high standards. It was often easier in the short term to hire allied warriors from the same sort of tribes and leaders who were attacking the empire. Controlling such forces proved difficult, not least because constant power struggles within the empire meant that it was easy for such bands to find themselves on the losing side of a civil war, and suddenly without a paymaster. Saxons from northern Germany are said to have raided Britain in 367. By the beginning of the 4th century, there was an army officer with the title Count of the Saxon Shore, Comes Litoris Saxonici per Britannias, commanding bases along the eastern and southern coasts. Opinion is divided as to whether he was there to defend against Saxon attacks from the sea or to command Saxon allies serving with the Roman army who garrisoned these bases. By this time, the units on the wall were part of a separate section of the army, led by the Dux Britanniarum, and Britain had been split into 4 or 5 provinces. An impression of insecurity is fed by the fact that every significant town on the island acquired defensive walls during the 4th century, if not before. As is so often the case, The evidence is so poor that we simply cannot gauge the scale and frequency of raiding or those areas most affected. Many attacks seem to have come by sea, which was no doubt easier.